your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
We haven't talked, I think, in all my 29 years, about a kind of work that many, many people want to do. And some succeed and many fail. So I thought that I would focus today's show, certainly the first segment, on starting and succeeding in private practice. Even though the unemployment rate is the lowest in about 50 years, many people are attracted to self-employment, and a particularly intriguing type of self-employment is private practice. Whether you're a therapist or a doctor or a lawyer, an architect or a career counselor like me, many people prefer the autonomy and the control of private practice over having to play by the rules and the politics in organizations. But starting and succeeding, especially in private practice, can understandably feel daunting. I hope this little mini-lecture, if you will help. Especially when you're starting out, it's tempting to be a generalist, not have a niche, not be a specialist. After all, when you're a newbie, you don't feel expert at much of anything. Besides, when you're struggling financially, and in the beginning of any starting a business you feel like you're struggling, it's hard to turn away clients, even when their particular problem isn't in your, let's call it, wheelhouse. But do realize that specialization has many advantages. And if you learn in the time-effective way I'm going to describe in a minute or so, you can often, in a short time, be good enough at your specialty, at your niche, to legitimately claim that you are a specialist. No, in the beginning, you're not going to be world-class, but your fee won't be either, or it shouldn't be at least. Being a specialist allows you to feel real expertise. It reduces the imposter syndrome that is pervasive, especially among generalists. Also, being a specialist allows you to market in a targeted way. For example, as an anger management specialist or interracial relationship specialist rather than generic counselor or therapist. Not only does specialization reduce your marketing effort and costs, most clients would rather consult with someone who specializes in their problem. What niche, though? You got to pick one that builds on your natural strengths, your experiences, and your interests, but do keep the market in mind. For example, and this is nobody's got a crystal ball, but in my mind, growth niches would seem to be, let's say in the counseling arena, counseling on marijuana and other substance abuse, given that it's now legal recreationally. LGBT or interracial couples, that's a very growing kind of couple. If you're a lawyer, specializing in employee claims, those continue to rise, especially here in the Bay Area. Or in immigration, we're clearly going to be, I hate the cliche, but what the rubber is meeting the road right now around immigration issues. And so clearly lawyers specializing in immigration are going to, I guess, seems clear to me, they're going to do well. If you're an architect, you know, where everybody is reducing the amount of space, whether it be for green reasons or financial reasons. So architects specializing in small space housing or mixed use infill housing. You know, there's nobody wants to live in Antioch and Pittsburgh. That's too strong, but it's challenging to live in Antioch or Pittsburgh because they're not building any more freeways and the traffic is growing and growing and growing and they're adding, quote, talk about a misnomer, express lanes, which merely means you get to pay more to be in one of the lanes. So it seems to me that architects specializing in small-use infill housing are a kind of a growing niche. Physicians, a significant part of my practice, really fast-growing areas, and I'm looking at Joanne Marr here, palliative care, absolutely growing. Specialists in that, or tropical diseases. Career counselors, you know, my profession, specializing in nonprofits. There's a especially here in the Bay Area, tremendous and growing antipathy to for-profit, even the word profit. And, of course, high-tech employment, which here in the Bay Area, it's the epicenter of that. My niche, in case you're curious, is what I call brilliant strugglers. These are doctors, lawyers, professors, psychotherapists, and so on, who, despite having high IQ, struggle professionally, often personally. Now, I mentioned a minute ago that I was going to talk about how to learn your specialty in a time-effective way. whether your field requires certification for basic employment, like a psychotherapist, doctor, or lawyer, or let's say it doesn't, as in the case of consultants and coaches, you can often learn your specialty more efficiently than with courses, let alone certificates or degrees. Those courses, certificates, and degrees are inefficient because you're learning masses of material all at once at a pace that may not suit yours. And if you're taking the courses at university, they're very often taught by academics, kind of sometimes out of touch and theoretical, rather than by master practitioners, which is the way to get trained if you're trying to be a master practitioner. I think that the model that I personally use to become a career counselor is appropriate for in many fields, many people, not for everybody, nothing works for everybody. But I started by reading a well-reviewed introductory textbook on career counseling. And in the margins, I wrote questions and comments. And in a Word file, I recorded nuggets that I wouldn't remember but wanted to. That way I wasn't writing down everything because that would overwhelm me. I just wrote down the nuggets that, you know, not that I would, those that I automatically would remember, I didn't write down. Only the ones that I might not remember but wanted to. I then attended a conference of career counselors, a major one, and I asked the speakers, who seemed to be the best career counselors, if I could ask them the questions that I had written in my note, in my book's margins. Then I asked if I could watch local ones, doing sessions with client permission, of course. And later, I had them watch me doing volunteer career counseling. Of course, I asked them for honest feedback as well as the client. I always asked the clients for honest feedback. And when I felt that I was adding sufficient value, that's when I started charging clients. But I was still endlessly asking for honest feedback. And I continued to read articles that would and watch YouTube videos that would help me with whatever particular problem within my career counseling practice I was struggling with. I usually found those articles simply with a Google search. But with just that training, which doesn't take a lot of time and almost no money, I had a full career counseling practice. I've had one for almost 30 years now. And almost all my clients are satisfied. Maybe 1 in 20 isn't? Something like that. Anyway, now let's turn to getting clients. Think about yourself. If you're picking a helping professional, if you're like most people, you use a personal referral or you look at Yelp reviews. But when you're starting out, if you are this person who is in private practice, whatever the field, you don't have Yelp reviews and you don't have past clients to refer who will refer you. So you've got to begin, and this is the way I would suggest you begin. You don't have to do anything, but create a simple website that describes what you do and your approach to it. Then make a list of your friends, your family, your colleagues that might hire you potentially or refer people to you. Email them the link to your website and maybe offer to get together with them. And that's really the most potent way to get started. Now, let's assume you have at least a few clients. Soon after you've finished working with a client, phone them up and say, for example, you popped into my head and I'm wondering how you're doing. Do not ask for referrals or whether they could use more sessions. That would make transparent that your main interest isn't them, but getting more clients. Now, this I'm going to say, I'm sure it's going to be surprising to you. I have not found writing articles or books, and I've written 3,500 articles and 12 books, or media appearances, and I've done a zillion, and 29 years hosting this show, to be a good source of clients. I think people think of a radio talk show as a talk show host, not so much as a counselor type or a helping professional type. I get 90% of my clients who are referred from my past clients or from friends and colleagues, only 5% from live speaking engagements, and only 5% from my books, articles, and radio and TV appearances. I mean, even like I was on The Daily Show. That was huge. I've been on This Morning America, the Today Show, all of that. I didn't get a single client from any of that. Anyway, in the personal, when you're hiring somebody personally, it's about you need to experience them through a referral or a Yelp review, generally, and that's where you need to put your efforts. Now, I just want to talk briefly about running that first session, whatever you're doing. That first session is particularly important. You want to be sure that the client doesn't leave feeling that he or she gets too little or got too little to justify another session. So, as I do, I would urge you to have your new clients complete a probing questionnaire to email you to review at least an hour before your first session. That doesn't cost them anything, and you've got all this stuff now that you can really hit the ground running and make the session useful. Before I end this little mini lecture about private practice, I need to say a word about ethics. I don't know if it's consciously or not. I don't even know if the unconscious exists. But some practitioners in private practice tend to drag out the process so they can get more money or just simply keep the relationship going. Please be vigilant to getting your work done as quickly as possible with clients, of course, without the client feeling you're pushing them away. And I want to mention just one ethical issue specific to career counselors. I will not write people's resumes because employers use resumes not just as a recitation of work history, but as an index of the candidate's ability to think, to organize, present information clearly. If I write their resume, the employer gets, and the coworkers and eventually the customers, get as misleading a sense of the candidate as when a parent writes their kid's college application essay. Because if that candidate gets the job over somebody more qualified, a cosmic injustice, pardon the perhaps hyperbole, is done. Now, I just want to end by saying, look, people who give these little mini talks or articles or whatever, they tend to make everything seem so easy. I am not implying that self-employment, let alone private practice, is easy. Most people, in fact, conclude that they would rather give up the autonomy of being in private practice in exchange for not having to market, do the IT, the accounting, and so on. But for the right person, a private practice can be the ideal life, and it certainly has been for me and is for me. Anyway, now I'd like to invite you to call. If you are either in private practice, contemplating it, have a question or comment about private practice, either derived from what you just heard me say or not, the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco and KELW, for what I call a workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And I'm well aware that private practice is a niche that only a small segment of people are going to want to pursue. So I also did some thinking about, since I'm on this for today, I'm on this self-employment topic, I did some hard thinking about what my clients and I have done to try to help them come up with a business idea, more broadly, not a private practice idea, but a business idea that's worthy of that show Shark Tank, you know. But I want to prioritize you, my dear listeners, so I'm going to go to the phones in a minute. I'll give out the phone number again. If you have a question about being in private practice or any kind of work-related problem, the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi, I listen to your show on a regular basis, but this particular one's very apropos for me right now.
Great.
I was just laid off from a job that I had for 10 years working for a supplement company.
Mm-hmm.
They are moving to Utah, and they're restructuring, and they just felt that considering... I'm not sure exactly, but they basically said, well, you know, we liked you and you did good work and all that kind of stuff. And then they laid me off today and they gave me 3 months severance pay and 6 months of health care and put me in touch with an agency to work through my expertise. But I'm actually a licensed acupuncturist and I was in practice for 10 years in the 80s, but I maintained my license.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm fairly skilled in that arena. Also, I worked in primarily for the vitamin company in the quality department as a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I had my own company for 15 years doing inspections of houses for toxics, and I had a fairly successful company. It took a long time to get it up and running, but then the insurance industry changed, and they weren't covering mold, which was the big area.
Yes, right.
So now I'm...
Stacky
so
Botrus, I seem to remember that name for some crazy reason.
What's that?
Stacky Botrus, I seem to remember that name.
Oh, yes, toxic mold and all that. And
right.
So, you know, and I got sick fairly badly with Lyme disease.
Whoa.
For a while.
Whoa.
And I actually was retired for a while.
Wow.
Until I ran out of money. And then a good friend of mine who owned the company at the time, the vitamin company, got me the job, and I stayed there basically for 10 years. up until last year, I worked only 4 days a week because I got hired by another colleague to do research, clinical, you know, to do scientific research for his burgeoning testing company. So I work 1 day a week for him still. And so anyway, so I'm now in the position and I actually hit retirement next year, not next year, this March. So now I'm in the position of considering going back into private practice. And I understand the idea of specialization because I realize you have to have a unique niche. I mean, there are over, my license is in the 2000s, and now there's 11,000 acupuncturists in California. So, you know, and so the piece of the pie is way different than it was, you know, in the 80s.
Absolutely. So your question is how to niche yourself within acupuncture?
Or within, you know, alternative complementary medicine, because of my experience in working for the supplement company, and my knowledge base is actually much broader. I'm also a homeopath. I was a homeopath. And
it would seem, I may be wrong, but given, as you correctly point out, you know, there is an acupuncturist under every rock in the Bay Area, where there is a quality control pharmaceutical or nutraceutical guy under every rock, and yet every company needs them. Would you find it, you know, more, depending on how important money is to you, would it be wiser to specialize as a quality control person in the supplement business than to try to compete in this crazy market for acupuncturists?
Well, it's possible. As a consultant, maybe. I don't know necessarily think that it would be a great idea for me to go back into working, you know, a 9-to-5 job.
No, I'm saying as a consultant, you know.
As a consultant.
Right. Yeah. Let's say I'm a company and I am, you know, I'm terrified of sourcing from China because, the stuff is tainted, and I need somebody who's going to make sure, you know, before the FDA comes in, I've got to make sure. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to hire somebody full time, but I might hire him for a month to look through all my SKUs and see whether the stuff is crap or not.
Right, right. There's a lot of potential in doing that kind of thing. And
right.
I thought about that as a possibility. I mean, it would be easier work for me than, you know, going back and seeing patients. You know, seeing patients is very demanding.
Being patients is kind of fun. The problem is going to be getting them when you've got 10 zillion acupuncturists here in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
Seeing them is great.
My colleague who hired me is a physician, an alternative medical physician specializing in Lyme disease, and he developed a company recently, which I've been hired in their technical and research department to test people for various toxic compounds, you know, whether they be mycotoxins or pesticides or organochlorines or whatever. So I've been doing all the worst research work for them, going through the literature to make that literature and, you know, creating reports on the various different things. So they hired me one day a week as a consultant to do that, and then he wants to hire me another day to work possibly in his clinic in San Rafael. So, you know, but I need to, like you said, I need to fill a couple more days.
Let me ask you a hard question. You know, I'm kind of a mainstream guy around medicine, and Consumer Reports laughs, for example, at homeopathy. They say it's a fraud. Micro doses of these things, you know, and it's true of most supplements. There was a big meta evaluation of supplements that found that 95% of them do no good whatsoever. You know, as they say, expensive urine. If you were to trust, you know, you're of retirement age, you know, as you were, you know, hopefully 30 years from now, you're on your deathbed and you're looking back on your life, would you feel okay about, you know, doing all these microtox studies about, you know, about compounds that where the evidence for their danger is really small, and then you freak out people? Does this really feel cosmically just?
Well, actually, to tell you the truth, there's two elements to that. One is that, you know, in my experience, clinical experience of working for 10 years, seeing patients, 40, 50 patients a week, as a homeopath and acupuncturist and Chinese medical doctor simultaneously, my experience was the deepest and most profound medicine was homeopathy.
Well, I'm going to interrupt you because it's off topic, but I do need to say that anecdote, you know, you're a site, you say you call yourself a scientist. Anecdotal evidence from your experience doesn't begin to stand up against the massive amount of data. Anyway, let's change topic. So let's talk about topic. No. Let's talk about the moral thing. You're not going there. So let's say you're happy to do these tox studies for this doc, and you need a couple more days. is it wiser for you to find another alternative medicine doc or three and do the same work for them?
Well, that's one idea that I had, was possibly, you know, working. I have another doctor, a dentist colleague of mine, that it's possible that I could work down in Sunnyvale one day a week in her clinic. The laboratory research work is totally independent from the medical, being an acupuncturist.
I understand that. I'm pushing you from this phone call. I can't, be a cheerleader for you trying to be, after you haven't practiced in a zillion years, starting a new practice in this absolutely oversubscribed field of acupuncture.
Right.
Whereas
right.
this field, if there are certainly a lot of people who are very unhappy with allopathic medicine, with standard Western medicine, the Bay Area is the epicenter of that. You've got one doctor doing it. And I don't think that going to your friend who happens to be a dentist, it feels a little, I'll be really honest, a little lazy. There are going to be doctors who are world-class in alternative medicine. In fact, at UCSF, where I've been teaching for the last 4 years, there are actually a center for alternative and complementary medicine, and there are some very well-respected doctors who do both Western medicine and alternative medicine, Chinese medicine, etc. I'm wondering whether your smartest move financially and also just, would be to find some other doc parallel to the kind of doc you're doing and do those tests for that person, for that other doctor or two, which will get you your other 2 or 3 days, rather than try to buck up against the tidal wave, the tsunami of market of these acupressurists and acupuncturists. What do you think?
Well, there's a little misinformation. The research work is totally independent. But what I could do is go to, I could put myself out there for a couple more days to other doctors who are looking for acupuncturists or homeopath or complementary medical person to work in their clinic as a
practitioner. Yeah, that's not where I'm
going.
Anyway, we're now going over things again. It seems to me that anything related to acupuncture is going to be too risky. I think whether you're doing clinical tests for an individual practitioner, or you're doing, I don't think being an independent researcher at this point, it could be the fastest way to dissipate whatever retirement savings you have. It seems to me your smarter options, if you want to be, you don't want 9 to 5, would be either on a consulting basis to go to nutraceutical companies and test for purity, et cetera, and that could make you good money, and then supplement that by doing individual blood test, urine test analysis on these, what doesn't get covered by Quest Diagnostic or LabCorp, that you believe is worth doing. That's my best take, and so I'm going to thank you for going to work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you.
Yep.
Bye.
You know, I like to be supportive where I can, but I am not doing you or anybody else, my listeners or the caller, any service by just saying, you go, boy. So, if I haven't scared you off, if you are either in private practice or contemplating it, and you would like my advice, one thing you will get for sure is my straight shooting and the fact that I've had 5,500 clients, been doing the show for 29 years, and you're getting it for free. This is my pro bono work here on KALW. If you've got a problem, an issue related to your being in private practice or any kind of work-related problem, the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Before I took the call, I promised you that I was going to broaden from just talking about how to start and succeed in private practice to the idea of developing a business idea that's great, what I will say worthy of Shark Tank, that very popular TV show. Because so many people think that what they really need, they'd love to be self-employed, but they don't have a lot of money, they don't want to take a lot of risk. But they would love to come up with the kind of business idea that would even make the sharks on Shark Tank, even the toughest shark, Kevin O'Leary, that bald guy, should make that guy want to invest, or should I say bite, Shark Tank. Anyway, here's a summary of kind of how I help my clients develop such a plan. I want to start with, my clients are not all alike. I have some that are passion-driven and others that are more money-driven. And my approach is different depending upon the client. But I'm seeing my calls coming in, so I'd rather hold off on telling you about how I would develop, how I help my clients come up with business ideas, but I'd rather go to the phones. So let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi, I'm Patty.
Hi, Patty.
Hi. So I'm a massage therapist. I'm looking to just start my own private practice.
Mm-hmm.
I've been advised to do a business plan, but I kind of feel like some of these business plans are a little bit involved for me. I I'm not going to be in like employing anyone. I'm not going to be doing retail. It's just going to be me paying rent. And the way that I kind of base things is I should be making my rent within 1 week's worth of business.
Okay, let me interrupt you. I got it.
How should I go about in terms of like a business plan?
Right. I think the word business plan is very misleading. Most business plans can be 2-3 page documents that basically say, what is the service, the type of services, in your case, the type of massage you want to focus on? Two, where are you going to do it? Should you be traveling and going to places, or should you be doing it in your home, in a free community center? Do you need to incur rent? That's a pain in the butt. You're going to be spending all your money in rent. How are you going to market? What is going to be your approach to marketing? Where are you going to get the money? And reasonable projections for, and this is what's guesswork, BS, but it's better to have it than not, to say, how many clients am I going to need at what dollars per hour to make to make decent money? That's it. It can be done in 3 pages. So I want to, for purpose of this radio show, I want to be really, you know, I'm going to propose a very specific vision for you, and you tell me what you like and don't like about it, and we'll work from there. How's that sound?
That's fine.
Great. Now, massage is, again, it's in most niches, it's a commodity. But for people who are ill, who have cancer or other end-of-life or end-of-life problems, massage has a critical pain reduction as well as comforting component to it. How do you feel about specializing in medical massage, going whether it be into hospitals or into senior living facilities, assisted living facilities, memory care facilities, whatever, and charging, therefore, a premium price, because it isn't as fun to work with them than some 25-year-old in perfect condition. And if you don't have the skills yet, do whatever it takes. Take a course, find a tutor, get mentored, be an apprentice to some master medical masseuse or masseur, and you market simply by going to from assisted living facility to assisted living facility and either doing maybe some free workshops for some free massages for one day to introduce yourself to the residents. I'm going to stop there, and that avoids you having to pay any rent. What do you like and not like about that particular mini business plan?
Okay. So I already work for a chiropractor, so I'm already doing kind of the medical massage end of it. I'm also proficient with craniosacral therapy, which is very indicated for chronic pain issues such as migraine, but it's great for anxiety, depression, and sleeplessness. In terms of where I would be basing my business, I have a line on a space that basically has a built-in clientele. So the space I would be renting would be below a hair and nail salon. So I would already have clientele, you know, kind of built in, but I can also still market to chiropractors in the area for people who might want craniosacral therapy, sports massage, or a more therapeutic deep tissue.
Okay, so it sounds like you want to do that. Now, have you calculated, given your rent and the existing client base, will you do well doing that?
I believe I would, because I have, with my equation, it is, you should make your rent with 1 week's worth of pay. So what I am kind of hoping upon is, with what I charge for like 60-minute session or for 90-minute session, and for what I would be available for, I would hope that I could make the $500 within 1 week and pay my rent within like 1 week of work.
And would you be, it feels like a very, I may be wrong, but it feels like a typical generic, that's pretty much what standard massage therapists do, non-sexual massage therapists do. And I worry that you're going to be on your feet all the time. You're going to be like a machine working to make that money when you're working for somebody else and paying that rent. I'm just worried that your net income and how, you know, how much longevity that'll have. Am I worrying too much?
You are, yes, because I've been doing this for 15 years, and so I've worked in spas in Las Vegas and have been on my feet for 10-hour shifts, and I currently, you know, I'm currently working, you know, a bit of hours for, you know, chiropractor, and I'm still holding up, so...
we're talking about a long-term plan. You know, where if you've been doing it 15 years, you're probably 40 years old now, something like that.
A little older.
Yeah.
But the thing with craniosacral is it's a lot easier on your body.
I see.
So if I'm, yeah, so with that, it takes a lot, yeah, it takes a lot of pressure off your body.
So it sounds really like you're not, you've got your business plan in your brain already, so you're just worried about the dawn thing, you think you might need some 70-page business plan or something? Is that the concern you've got?
Kind of. I mean, it's like someone put it in my head, oh, you need a business plan. And so I just feel like it's, for me, it's just so simple that do I really need a business plan?
As long as you know you're going to have, where you're going to get your clients from, that you're going to be able to make a reasonable amount of income for the amount of effort involved, and you're not going to need any money to start up, particularly you don't have to worry about investing, then no, you know, it doesn't sound like you need much more than that. I just raised some hard questions about, you know, you want to, if you, you know, some people are not planners. They just live from day to day or week to week or year to year and say, hey, you know, for now it's cool, I'll do this and I'll worry about it again in a year. That's fine. But normally when people start a business, they're hoping to do it for 5 or 10 years at least. And that's what made me a little nervous about, you're over 40 and, you know, I'm glad to hear, I didn't know anything about craniosacral and I've never been to a chiropractor. So, you know, but if you're saying it's not going to be hard on you, that's fine. But I'm just, you know, I'm just inviting you to think about, is this a long-term solution or is this something, you know, now? But for what you've described, you certainly don't need much of a business plan. But make it 2 pages. Write down the limit, the range of services that you want to provide. Write down, you know, how you're going to get the clients. Write down what you feel is the hourly rate you're going to want to try. Figure out what you're going to do to market to get additional clients other than the ones that walk in the door. Think about perhaps then if any money, where you're going to need to get any money that you might need for equipment or marketing or whatever. And then maybe what a next step might be. Maybe just theoretically, if 3 years from now you're sick of doing it already and now you want to do something else, what would be your exit strategy? Would you hire somebody? Would you grow? Would you change the specialty? And just do that on a few pieces of paper. Show it to somebody or a couple of people who are expert massage therapists who won't feel that you're competing with them, and that could be all the business plan you need. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, because that's already what I've already done in my head anyway. So
write it down. You know, in writing, you find great clarity that comes from writing that you wouldn't even have thought about. That's why I encourage one. I think maybe the most potent self-help method for anybody with problems is journaling, because it forces you to, you're not ceding control over your advice, the advice you're going to take to anybody else. You know yourself better than some psychologist or whatever. So journaling is often very useful. In fact, I tell a lot of my clients to keep a little memo pad or use the memo function on their phone through the day. Just keep little notes about this and that or whatever. So writing things down may be a low-risk way for you to develop this thing called a business plan. And then when your friend says, you should have a business plan, you can even wave it in front of them. All right. Anyway, that's my best advice. Thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. We're talking private practice mainly, and I'm now going to be starting talking about coming up with a business idea. But if you have a question or comment about private practice or any kind of work-related problem, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And before I went to the phones, I was talking about how to develop a business plan that might even convince the sharks on Shark Tank to invest. And I said, I was just starting to say that I have two kinds of clients, and I'd use a different approach with each of the two kinds of clients. Many of my clients are passion-driven. Some are money-driven. I'll talk about them in a minute. But many of my clients are passion-driven. They would put in the work to create a business only if the product or service was something that they were passionate about. So with those clients, I will invite them to inventory their life to identify pain points and pleasure points. First, I ask them to think through a typical day from the moment they wake up until the moment they're asleep. I ask them, okay, what annoys you that a product or service could solve? For example, a client told me recently last week that she's annoyed that she has to futz quite a bit with her pillow until her head nestles between its sides, yet there still is enough filling left in the middle that it feels soft. So I came up with this idea of a pillow in which the sides are bendable and yet retain the new shape, and that the middle would be overfilled with little Tyvek, you know, packets of foam that are in Tyvek, little Tyvek bags. Some of them would be firmer little packets, some would be softer. And the user, when they first buy the pillow, would simply unzip the pillow, remove some of one or both types of the packets, the hard packets or the softer packets, until it's perfect for them. That way they get a custom pillow very easily. Now, the client and I ended up coming up with ideas she likes better than that. And she said she will not pursue the pillow idea, or I wouldn't have described it to you, or she would have been really mad at me. I also ask clients to inventory their life's components. This is, again, passion-driven clients. Their work, their transportation, their physical health, their mental health, relationships, recreation, their home. And I ask, do you have any pleasure points or pain points there? For example, I had a client who really values her home being, she used the term, welcoming. So we mentally walked through her home, which spawned this idea. She said, "Hey, custom welcome mats." And we talked about this, and I said we could put a photo of the buyer's choosing, you know, like when you buy a mug, you can have it, you know, you can have whatever photo you want put on the mug. A welcome mat with a photo of the buyer's choosing, maybe a family photo, permanently inkjet into the mat. And the mats would be sold on the net, or she could license the technology to a website like Etsy or Zazzle or Cafe Press that sells personalized items. And again, I got to say, we came up with other ideas that she likes better, or I would not have revealed this one here. Now, as I said, there are other people who don't need to feel passion for the product. They're about the money. They feel they'll get passionate enough about it as long as the financial prospects are good. For those clients, we walk through their work and their personal life to identify not their passions, but customers' unmet needs. For example, I had a client who worked for a corporation that had offices on both sides of the New York and New Jersey sides of the Hudson River. And the company had spent a fortune on taxis for its employees to go to and from its two offices. Well, my client showed the company how it could save a lot of money, while still leaving him with plenty of profit in his little business here, as you're going to hear, to shuttle employees from one side to the other. And he had no particular interest in shuttle vans, but he saw that it was a low-risk, high-payoff business, and he did it. And if he decides he wants more money, it's an idea that could be done for other companies in similar situations. Now, I want to talk about the business plan, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But before I do that, we have calls on the line, so let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hello, are you there? Hello? Are you there? Last time, feel free to call back. Okay, so now I want to take that as an opportunity. Let me talk about the business plan for, you know, again, one that might well be worthy of Shark Tank. Money is any business's and any nonprofit's lifeblood. You can't afford to bleed out before more money pours in. So it's crucial for a startup to conduct what I call low-risk experiments to determine where to spend money and even whether to continue the business. So let's take that pillow example I was just mentioning. First of all, of course, name matters. Maybe it could be called the taco pillow. That's alliterative. It makes one curious as to what the hell it means. It means there's going to be salsa on the pillow. And it describes the pillow's functionality. That is, it nesting your head between the pillow's two moldable foam sides, like a taco. Next, I would do a Google search to see if that kind of foams, those foams, the firmer one and not, and one that's bendable and yet will stay erect, are available. Whether it would need to be custom made. And I would supplement that Google search with a phone call to a major foam retailer. There's one, like, for example, I think it's called the Foam Shop in Berkeley on San Pablo Avenue, for example, or find some manufacturer and talk to them and find out. And which, again, I'd get that from a Google search. And for the prototype, unless I could inexpensively get a custom foam sample made for my pillow, I would use commercially available foam for the sides and for those little packets that would go into the Tyvek. You know, for those of you who don't know, Tyvek is this very strong, it feels like shiny paper, but it's very strong and it can be used for this. Anyway, if I needed to, certainly wouldn't hire companies or anything. I would hand stuff and glue shut those packets. Now, of course, if later I decided to go in production, I would certainly investigate using custom foams so that the product was so good that the word of mouth, which is the best form of marketing, and the online reviews would be exceptional. I would then, and again, this is the cheapest way to do marketing. This is guerrilla marketing, in my mind, at its finest. I would throw a party in which I asked attendees to try that prototype pillow, beg for honest feedback, and to make suggestions about its name. What do they think about, Taco Pillow, the logo, what designs for a logo, pricing, what was the most they would pay for it, how it should be manufactured, anything they knew about, distribution, package, what the packaging might be like, how to market, how to raise the money. And then, with that prototype and those ideas in hand, I would visit a local boutique store that sold pillows and a high-volume department store like Macy's. Macy's has a big, especially downtown San Francisco, has a big bedding department. And I would try to talk with the manager there, and I would ask for honest feedback on whether he or she thought it would sell and at what price, and any suggestions she might have about packaging, labeling, all the rest of it. So I think you see that with a lot less cost, time, and hassle, and probably a lot of fun, you may be able to go from clueless to a good business plan, a simple one, that promises self-sufficiency and control of your destiny. Or maybe you'll have the sense that you'd be wiser to try something else or not even be self-employed, which is worthwhile in itself. Anyway, phone number again. I'm going to go to the phones in a moment. If you have a question about self-employment, whether private practice or not, or any kind of work-related problem, I do what are called workovers, helping you try to solve it. The phone number here, work with whether you're 16 or 76 or self-employed or working for a corporation or a nonprofit, the phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now back to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hello? Are you there?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, yes, this is Jane.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. I had a question. I am going to be an empty nester, and I'm single. I have my degree. I went back to get our past courses, and I'm getting ready to take the real estate exam.
Okay.
And the thinking I have behind this is, because of my age, women tend to do well in real estate. And it's one of the few industries you can kind of re-enter.
Okay.
And so I was just wanting to hear some of your thoughts about it, and also in regards to the specializing.
Absolutely.
Because I know there's a lot of different areas that you can spin off in real estate.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, because the barriers to entry to real estate are low, there are a zillion real estate agents, and disproportionately they're women.
Yes.
So being a woman is not going to give you an edge. You desperately need a niche, and unfortunately, I'm somebody who is kind of I find marketing anathema, but it's really all about marketing. The successful real estates live and breathe it. They have a niche, and I'll just throw out some niches, for example. Niches could be toxic waste property. I know this is not the sexiest, but I'm trying to get you, everybody likes to sell $10 million houses that are pretty and wonderful in Piedmont and Hillsborough and whatever. But, then your odds are one in a hundred or a thousand, unless you're amazing unless you have amazing connections where people would say, oh, out to hell with the experienced realtor who sold 20 $10 million houses. I'll hire Jane because she's nice, But unless you have...
And I am.
So is that what you want to go for? I mean, do you want to try to compete in that? That's the most competitive part of the market. The 3 million to $15 million homes in Piedmont, in Hillsborough, in Alamo, is that where you want to be, or you want a less competitive niche?
A less competitive, and I am on the peninsula, but there are some affordable housing in some of the areas that are close to me.
Right.
And I'm from the peninsula. I grew up
fair enough.
Born and raised.
But not Woodside, not Los Altos Hills. Because again, there were 10,000 sharks out there trolling in every way, emails, door to door. They give parties. They get involved in the local community, volunteer at nice nonprofits where they can schmooze. It is a shark fest, but they're all size 2 and just all smiley and perky. And it is really hard to differentiate yourself in that market because every one of those people sees big dollar signs and they're fighting over a very small number of them because there aren't that many that turn over. So you talk about affordable housing. Then the niche is going to be something like being a condo specialist, being a specialist in some repossessed housing, being a rental, of course it's true, although rents have gone through the roof, that fewer and fewer people, unless you're, two anesthesiologists or high-tech people who cashed out with $10 trillion, the vast majority of people can't afford a house. I mean, I know, houses in Palo Alto, crappy houses, $2 million in Palo Alto.
Yeah,
that's absurd.
Absolutely.
And nobody can afford it. That's just, it's a house of cards. I think it's going to crash anyway. But there are people who want to live. So if you know the bad areas that are probably gentrifying because formerly middle to upper middle class people can't afford, expensive housing in San Mateo. So they're going to have to live in the bad parts of Burlingame and Redwood City. If you made that your specialty, and let's just say, I don't know anything about your socioeconomic status, but let's say you are middle class because you were salivating at those $10 million houses, so I'm assuming you're kind of middle class in values. What you might specialize in is marketing to middle class people who, for economic reasons, have to downscale to the less expensive parts of the peninsula and helping them to find, A, places that will work that are gentrifying, and B, getting those, if you're representing a seller, staging them in a way that will be palatable to renters or buyers of those properties, even though the neighborhood isn't exactly gilt-edged. What do you think of that niche?
That actually does sound a very good entry into the market, and it does seem that the first-time buyers are going to be what I'll be able to work with.
Or renters. Again, buyers.
Or renters, yeah. Yep. Property management is a good
Not just management. I'm talking about helping people find under-the-radar rentals. People are over...
Oh, investment properties, I see.
Nope. I'm going to give you an example. Let's say I am a social worker, and I'm making $50,000 a year. I want to find a place where I'm not going to be terrified to run out of my house, every night or every morning go to work. And so there's always a small percentage of rentals that are under market or with some fixing up could be great and aren't going to cost $3,000 a month for a studio. And so specializing in unearthing those rentals for that person, and you would get a commission, which is usually 10%, I believe, maybe of the first year's rent, I don't remember. You'd be paid by the landlord, and you would help these people who are looking for an affordable, decent apartment to get that apartment. That feels to be going with the wave of the middle class is getting very, very hollowed out. They can't afford these $2 million or even $1 million or even $500,000 houses. We throw around and we say, $500,000 is a cheap house. That's $500,000.
Yeah.
But so there's a hell of a lot of people who have very little money and want to stay in at least a decent place. But and so you're specializing, you're branding yourself as the rental specialist in and again, I don't know the peninsula well, but I think about Redwood City and I think of Burlingame or whatever, or Pacific on the other side of the mountain. Being that specialist could be a different enough branding that might enable you to succeed rather than having to compete in that shark tank that's competing for Woodside and Hillsborough and Los Altos Hills. What do you think?
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it. And thank you for doing this show.
It's my pleasure. It's a privilege. Anyway, thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemco. I wish you the best.
Thanks.
Take care. Phone number again, if you've got a work-related problem, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Now I want to turn this, we don't want to just focus on self-employment here. I was reading the headline of the San Jose Mercury News, which also it was on the Oakland Tribune, all the those whatever Bay Area news group, and it the headline, the top front page headline is "Economy Propels Bay Area Job Market." Subtitle: hard to argue with these numbers. And that article cites the Center for Continuing Study of the California Economy, and this is the quote: "People are being drawn back into the job market by the strong economy and willingness of employers to hire people that they might not have looked at before. This is very good news for job seekers," end quote. I like to give good news where I can, and that was really front page news. It also, the article also said that 2018 showed the biggest gain in jobs in 2 years. So I want to talk about, this is a great time if you've gotten a job offer. You've got more leverage than you will have had in previous years. And I want to talk about what to do when you've just gotten a job offer. But again, I do like to prioritize you, my dear listeners. So let's go to the phones first. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi.
Hello.
I'm calling because I was thinking of going to school to become an anesthetician. And I was wondering,
an anesthesiology assistant. There's a big world of difference between esthetician and anything related to anesthesia. Which we were talking about?
No, it's not anesthesia.
Right.
It's cosmetology.
Okay,
school,
there we go.
And it's about facials and eyelashes
and bikini waxes. Right. That's what an esthetician does. Okay. What's your question?
Just give me your thoughts about doing that.
You know what I've learned over the years,
trying to pretend you have your own business.
You know, as a guy, I got to tell you, you know, it's something that I don't begin to get, but no matter whether the economy is good or the economy is bad, people will spend on looking good. Makeup,
right.
You know, hair, clothes, jewelry, and yes, facials, pedicures, mani-pedis, and yes, waxing. And so I am bullish on that because I think it is pretty, and it certainly can't be offshore. Nobody's going to get their bikini wax from another country. So I'm optimistic. But what is in every field you want to be excellent, and the best way, in my judgment, to be excellent is to be an apprentice with somebody who's massively wonderful, who's got the greatest Yelp reviews. So either get your license, or you may need some practical hours before you can get your license. Find somebody, and I don't know if it's whether somebody you know or through the greatest Yelp reviews, who is really has the magical gift. Every field, it's not just a matter of being trained. Some people have a gift. It's like, I can't fix anything around the house, but I have the gift of being able to play the piano. I can't read music, but I can play anything by ear that I can hear. So we all have gifts and we all have liabilities. So find an esthetician who has the gift of making people feel comfortable, the gift of getting people to be really honest about what they really want and need, gift at maybe applying makeup. My sister runs a shop called Let's Make Up, and she's gifted at making women look amazing by putting on all this makeup stuff. So apprentice-wise, the niche is fine. It's not going away. People have cared about their looks from Cleopatra's age era on to today, and it ain't going away. It may not be henna anymore, although for some people it is, but niche is fine. The key is to differentiate yourself because, again, it's got low barriers to entry. It doesn't take a rocket science to become an esthetician, but to become an artist and somebody who is essentially like a psychologist who can really understand the emotional gaps that the client has and how their esthetician work, whether it be hair, eyebrows, makeup, facials, whatever, is going to solve. That's a gift. And so you want to, as much as possible, be mentored by somebody. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes total sense. So it seems like the first thing I should do is really talk to as many people as I can to find that person who who you say is gifted.
Or Yelp.
Or several people, and find out if any of them are going to be willing to work with me.
Yes. Now, you know, we all don't know that many people. So
right.
Yelp is amazing. Because, well, of course, there are some phony Yelp reviews. I have horror stories that I've heard written, that the bad reviews are written by the competitors to the business or whatever. But when a particular esthetician has 50 or 70 reviews, and the vast majority of them say she is amazing, that's valid. That's more valid probably than any personal reference you could get. Because let's say your friend uses an esthetician and she really loves the esthetician. That means that she loves that esthetician. It doesn't mean that in general she has the gift that would be applicable across a wide range of clients. Whereas the
right.
Some, right? So focus, I'd give more credibility to Yelp or whatever, you know, maybe there are even specialty websites that review the fashion or look space. This is not my world, hardly, as my wife would confirm in a moment. But find somebody amazing, do that first, and then before you even mentor with her, ask her, what should you read? Is there a course you should take? Who should you observe? What should you get her ideas on the best way to prepare, and then be diligent about following up, and then your odds are good. Does that make sense?
Yes, I'm so glad I called you. Thank you so much.
It is my pleasure. Thanks for calling. Okay, we don't have time. I was going to talk about how to negotiate in this era where we really are at the lowest unemployment rate in 50 years. Now, I'm well aware there's still many, many, many people who are underemployed, but the job market has never been better, and therefore, finally, I'm pleased to be able to offer you, if you are the job seeker, you can be more aggressive in trying to get a better deal, not just cash, but the million non-cash things. I have almost no... Joanne, do I have time for this? A quick one or no? Let me try. Okay, welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. In 10 seconds, tell me your question. The show is almost over.
My teenager is leaving home, and I am a teacher, and I'm really ready to do something else. I have a varied background apart from teaching and a good education, but I don't want to know what I want to do. So I'm trying to figure out, is career counseling worthwhile for someone?
Only in a niche. Position? There are certain niches in career counseling that are, you know, that are likely to be viable, whether it be specializing in nonprofit counseling or in high-tech counseling or biotech counseling or burned-out teachers because you were a teacher.
Right.
Focus on that and do all the reading you can about unhappy teachers and what they transition to. Very often teachers transition into sales because you are, in a sense, you're being very verbal. Teachers also work as textbook salesmen or in curriculum. They work for the Department of Education. They work for the district, the county. There's no bigger bureaucracy than education. So there is the local district, the county, the state, the feds, and interstitial agencies like SELPAs, which are special education. That I tried to cram as much as I could into the little time I had,
okay.
And I hope that is somehow, in some way, helpful to you. Thanks for calling
okay,
the show.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Okay, take care. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7 p.m. You can call in for a workover and Biyambajab Ulambayar on What's It Really Like to Be a Professional Sumo Wrestler. Until then, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.